question. We're going to deal with question 100, which is one of those interesting questions in the Catechism because it does not have any proof texts. So we're going to add our own proof text to it. We're going to talk about the ideas that are in there because it is giving us an outline of where we're going with the Ten Commandments. We've talked about the fact that they are a summary of the moral law and the uses of that. What we need to consider before we look at each command separately is the different parts, the way the Ten Commandments have come to us. If you consider the fact that we're told by James, for example, that if we fail, if we offend in one point, we've offended in all. That may not be obvious to a lot of people. Why would you say we've failed in everything? That's putting us in sort of a hopeless predicament. Well, there's very specific reasons why we can state that, and it has to do with the way the Ten Commandments have come to us. We do not consider the commandments an entity unto themselves, as if each one of these things were just sort of knit into it as individual pieces of a puzzle. Even the commandments as a unit are not really an entity unto itself. Remember, they're a summary. It's a summary statement. It's taking into account the fact that we need this much information summarized so that it's sort of at the tip of our fingers, at the tip of our tongues, so that we are able to think through moral points in a way that is logical, in a way that is embedded in the very fabric of creation. Morality is embedded in the fabric of creation. The moral law is the same, really, as the natural law. It's in the creation. It was concreated with all intelligent beings. Now, sin has eradicated the knowledge and understanding of that to a large extent in a lot of people. And people suppress that knowledge in unrighteousness. But we're not really talking about special revelation right now. We're talking about natural revelation. Everybody, we've talked about this, everybody knows the moral law. They start out knowing the moral law. They may suppress it in unrighteousness. They may try to chew away the intention of the law around the edges. But they can't get away from this idea that there's right and wrong, good and evil. And most people, even when they're going to be immoral in this way or that way, and we've talked about this, as well, they feel the need to make it up somewhere. They sense that the moral law has to be taken in its entirety, but they don't really understand why. We want to point up some of the reasons why. And the why, by the time we get to through this, the special things that we're to consider, hopefully will become more apparent.
You're talking about why people feel the need to balance out, like if they know in their heart of hearts they're really sinning badly in one area, they try and make it up by good deeds to other men or something like that.
They try to make it up. They sense that the law, the moral law, is a package deal. We can't really, they know deep down inside you can't pick and choose.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of interesting you say that, because I know these two homosexuals that are almost overly civilly nice and try to do, I mean, they just really try hard in the other direction to behave themselves well in almost every area of life but that. So I kind of see what you're saying there about the balance, that people try to balance it out for some reason.
Well, they sense that there's something about the moral law.
Yeah, I guess if they didn't understand it as a package deal, that whole system of checks and balances, so to speak, they would never even come to that funky conclusion.
Right. Like, it really trips them up a little bit, I think.
The fact is, the moral law is a package deal because it is at the center of both the covenant of works and the covenant of grace. It's included in both. Its intention is different in the covenant of grace than it is in the covenant of works. But it is included in both. The fact is that God can give us his law as a covenant of works without making it a covenant or bringing into it a covenant of grace. He can give it to us apart from the covenant of grace. But he will never give us a covenant of grace apart from the law. So the law can come to us apart from the covenant of grace, but the covenant of grace will never come to us apart from the law.
Is that sort of like saying that just because you're not saved doesn't mean you don't have to obey the law? Am I understanding what you're... I don't know.
Yeah, everybody is under obligation to this moral law.
Mm-hmm. All right. Saved or not. It doesn't
matter. Saved or not. And this is precisely why.
Gotcha.
The law comes to everyone in a covenantal way.
But even when you're saved, don't think that the law doesn't apply to you.
Correct.
Okay.
All right, let's begin to so we can clarify some of these points. Question 100. What special things are we to consider in the Ten Commandments? And the answer is that we're to consider in the Ten Commandments the preface, the substance of the commandments themselves, and several reasons annexed to some of them, the more to enforce them. So we see there are three things that are noted or notable about the Ten Commandments. But when we talk about special things, if we ask ourselves what are they trying to tell us when they call them special things? The catechism is holding out to us things which command peculiar attention. Things characterized by something distinct or particular which makes it exemplary. That's what a special thing is. Comes from the Latin specialis, which is individual, means individual, of a given species, which means appearance. So if we understand that, if we make it into English, a special thing is an individual appearance. Of note. The very fact that something appears and stands out of a species makes it of note. An individual is something of note. When the moment you can distinguish individual from species, you have something notable. In the Bible, the word special is used to translate the word segula, which is used to describe Israel as a peculiar treasure or possession. Look at Deuteronomy 7, verse 6.
Deuteronomy 7, 6. For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God, and Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth.
The translators use the word special to note Israel because Israel is a peculiar treasure or possession. What is it that makes of all the species of nations makes Israel stand out as that particular individual of note? Why is the entire Bible taken up with Israel? What's the importance? And the answer is Israel is notable as an individual which stands out of the group. Why? Well, in this case, God has called them out.
So we're talking to Israel as the people standing out from the other groups of people.
Right. In Deuteronomy, Numbers, Israel is noted as a nation which is standing alone. That they dwell alone. All right. Likewise, the word is used to translate the Greek words, which are literally not the ordinary ones, utas tukousas, that indicates something out of the ordinary. Look at Acts 19:11.
Acts 19, verse 11. And God wrought special miracles by the hands of Paul.
Yes, special miracles. Literally, the word translated special are all those words, not ordinary ones. There's a sense then in which there are ordinary miracles and there are special miracles. Paul is working special miracles. Even in the world of miracles, the things that Paul was doing, we're told, are standout. They present themselves as something very different from what we might think of as ordinary miracles. They're special miracles. The special thing that occurs in this case, in all likelihood, has to do with two things. One, the fact that these are, in fact, miracles which are attached to the proclamation of the gospel. But these are miracles in addition to that which are being done in peculiar ways. It's not just him laying hands on people, but this is one of these cases that a lot of Pentecostals have picked up, the idea of him touching things and them being taken to people who are sick and them touching them and being healed. Right. Special things are marked out as special things because they garner attention that invite a deeper contemplation. When we say something special, we're saying we need to stop and contemplate. Why? It's not ordinary. Why isn't it ordinary? What is peculiar about that? See, there is something peculiar about the Ten Commandments that everybody senses. I mean, they sense something about the moral law, that idea that it's a package. They get that. They get there's something peculiar about it. It stops them in their tracks. They give evidence, full evidence, that the work of the law is written in their hearts. There's no doubt that they know deep down inside that there is a right and there's a wrong. So it shouldn't come as a surprise then when the divines tell us that there are special things concerning the Ten Commandments. What is interesting is the things that they call attention to. They don't simply call attention to the substance of the commandments themselves. They call attention to more than that. They call attention to the preface, they call attention to the reasons annexed. There are very good reasons for them to do that. Let's begin to look at those. Question two, what is the purpose of a preface? Well, when we talk about a preface, we need to understand a preface is different from a foreword. A foreword might tell you something about why or how something came to be written. But a preface is more than that. A preface is at the beginning of a writing, and it serves generally to establish the credibility and authority of the author. We see this illustrated in Luke 1, verses 1 through 4.
Luke 1, verses 1 through 4. Forasmuch as many have taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration of those things which are most surely believed among us, even as they delivered them unto us, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write unto thee, in order, most excellent Theophilus, that thou mightest know the certainty of those things wherein thou hast been instructed.
Okay, so what does Luke tell us about his writing? No, he tells us something in a preface. He tells us something about himself. Why is it we should listen to Luke rather than these other accounts? What kind of position did he have that would make his account more credible than, say, the Gospel of Thomas, or now we're hearing all about the Gospel of Judas? Why is Luke better? Well, Luke is telling us some things here. He's telling us that there are other people who've written, first of all. he's aware of other gospels, but he's also telling us they're not really to be believed. Not all of them. Maybe some of them, but certainly not all of them. And he is making it very clear. He had perfect or complete knowledge of what it is he's going to write. He knew. He was there. He was there. He was close enough to people who were there. He is in an inner circle. Why is he in a position to write a gospel? He was there. He was an eyewitness.
He can bear witness to it.
He can bear witness to it. You know, in the case of other eyewitnesses, he too can claim to be an eyewitness. In the case of people who are not eyewitnesses, he's giving you a reason to believe that he, in fact, is someone credible. And that he has the authority to write what he's going to write. Right? He can also form a historical testimony concerning the matter under review. Look at Revelation 1, 1 through 3.
Revelation 1, verses 1 through 3. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John, who bare record of the word of God and of the testimony of Jesus Christ and of all things that he saw. Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand.
John tells us what, you know, why you're about to read this prophecy. Why should you believe it? John says some very interesting things about it himself here. He tells you that, again, he is an eyewitness. That's a different kind. He's the one who had the vision. This isn't some secondhand account. He had the vision. He heard it. He saw it. He beheld Christ. And he tells us something more. He tells us that he had the testimony of Jesus. That is to say, he already knew this kind of material. He was aware of the things, to some extent, that were in there. He's not unaware of everything that's being revealed in this prophecy. Some of it he is. But most importantly, and the thing that he's most conversant with, from what he tells us, is Jesus himself. So that when he has his vision, here's somebody who leaned on Jesus' bosom. Here's somebody who was, again, intimately acquainted with Christ. And he can say, I know the voice of the one shepherd. I know this is him. I know who talked to me. I know where this vision came from. This is not one of these visions where you're not really sure what's going on or why. John didn't need someone else to tell him whether or not it was Jesus speaking to him. John had already spoken with Jesus. John had walked with Jesus. John knows. Why should we believe Revelation? Well, in his preface, John says, look, I was with him. I have his testimony. And I saw this vision. And this vision is consonant with what I already know. Mm. All right. It can be considered then an apology for the writer, explaining and defending the right to presume to comment upon the matter under discussion. That's what he's doing. They're arguing. Luke, John, in a preface, an author is generally arguing with us a little bit, telling us historically why we ought to pay attention, giving us a little hint of what it is we ought to pay attention to, and then arguing the point.
Everybody does that when they want to. I mean, parents do that to their children. They argue that point. I've heard many parents say, "You should listen to me. I'm your father. I'm your mother." You're claiming a right.
Well, and this is the case. In the case of the moral law, the preface of the Ten Commandments is what? I am the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the house of bondage, out of the land of Egypt. Okay? Therefore, the Lord, in fact, lays forth his claim to credibility and authority by invocation of the covenant name, Jehovah, Adonai, Yahweh. Right there in the preface is the sacred name of God, the unpronounceable sacred name of God. The name that calls us every time we read it to shut our mouths and retreat in and think. The Jewish practice, Hebrew practice, is a good one. Keeping the vowel pointing out of there is not a bad thing. When you get to that, it's really asking you to stop what you're doing and turn inward in such a way that you are recognizing your utter dependence. Look at Exodus 6, verse 3.
Exodus 6, verse 3. And I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty, but by my name Jehovah was I not known to them.
Yeah, God tells Moses. He appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by the name of God Almighty, or Elohim Shaddai. But through Moses, God reveals himself with this sacred name. Sometimes translated Yahweh, sometimes Jehovah. But when we read our Hebrew, we say Adonai, because there really isn't any good fixed way of pronouncing this name.
So actually, that name, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong. When we read a Hebrew sentence or whatever, and you come upon that name, and it's unpronounceable, is that kind of hearkening back to the special thing? It's something that's totally different than the rest of... are they doing that so that you reflect upon the Lord?
So that we reflect upon this is a name that is given to God's people in covenantal context.
Right.
It's important that God's people realize that there is no relationship. No one has any kind of relationship with God apart from covenant. Everybody is either in covenant with God under a broken covenant of works or under a covenant of grace. There's no neutral zone. Only to those who are redeemed does God reveal himself in this covenant of grace. Okay. So in the writing of the preface, or the, in the preface of the moral law, the Lord first lays his claim to credibility based upon this covenant name. Jehovah is that tetragrammaton with the vowel pointing for Adonai. If you put the vowel pointing for Adonai under this sacred name and pronounce it, it will be Jehovah. Jehovah. That's where that name came from.
The vowel pointing for what?
For Adonai.
Oh, Adonai.
But clearly that's not Adonai. But nonetheless, that's where that comes from. All right. He also claims this right in giving them this summary of the moral law and the Ten Commandments based upon his redemption of his people. Look at Exodus 20, verse 1 and 2, and Leviticus 26, 13.
Exodus 20, 1 and 2. God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage.
Exodus 6, verse 3. Leviticus 26, verse 13. I am the Lord your God, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, that ye should not be their bondmen. And I have broken the bands of your yoke and made you go upright.
So, why is it we ought to listen to the law, the summary? Well, what do we know about it?
It's the law of God. Like, I mean, God's the one giving it to
God
us.
God is telling us in the republication of this moral law under Moses, he's telling us very clearly. Number one, this law is coming to you by way of covenant. That is everybody. But number two, he's saying to you in particular, this law is coming to you wrapped in a covenant of grace. And everyone else is getting this law just in a way of covenant. That is a covenant of works. You're getting it in a covenant of grace. How do we know that? How do we know that? Well, remember, I am that covenant God who brought you out of bondage. That is, I redeemed you. So what God does here is he presents historical testimony as the basis for the keeping of the law. Right? It forms then the Lord's own historical testimony upon which all human historical testimony must be founded. Look at Psalm 132:12, Psalm 19:7, and 1 Corinthians 2:1.
Psalm 132. If thy children will keep my covenant and my testimony that I shall teach them, their children shall also sit upon thy throne forevermore.
If thy children shall keep my covenant and my testimony. To keep God's testimony as well. Well, how do we keep God's testimony? We'll talk about that more in a minute. Keep going.
Psalm 19, verse 7. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple.
The law is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony makes wise the simple. Testimony is doing something different than the law in all of this. It's different from the covenant. It's different from the law. But it's bound up in what we're going to talk about here. Right, 1 Corinthians 2, 1.
1 Corinthians 2, verse 1.
And I, brethren, when I came to you, came not with excellency of speech or of wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God.
Paul says he's declaring unto you the testimony of God. It's not his own testimony. He's declaring unto you the testimony of God. What is the testimony of God? God's historical testimony is this. Look, I redeemed you. I brought you out of the house of bondage. I redeemed you. That's why you ought to keep the law. Not as a covenant of works. Everybody was under that law as a covenant of works, but that is a failure. Right? If you do that, you're going to die. I'm giving this law back to you again, having had it broken in your hands. But I'm giving it back to you again as a rule of obedience. Why should you do it? Because I redeemed you. Not in order to be saved. He's already said, and this is Moses telling Israel. This is not a New Testament idea, if you will. Redemption goes before the keeping of the law. This historical reality lends its name to the ark into which the tablets of stone were placed. Exodus 25:21.
Exodus 25:21. And thou shalt put the mercy seat above the ark, and in the ark thou shalt put the testimony that I shall give thee.
The mercy seat is placed over the ark, which is called the Ark of the
Covenant,
and it's also called the Ark of the Testimony. Why? Well, because the ark symbolizes a covenant of God with his people, but it also contains God's testimony. What is God's testimony in there? Well, remember, he actually wrote this law on the tables of stone. This is why he writes a preface to it. You know, this is, if you want to look at one part of the Bible that he actually wrote with his own finger, it's these 10 words. The preface is the information, that historical information that you need so that the law does not become a republication of the covenant of works to you. If you don't know God's testimony, you will always fall back on the law and try to keep the law. Now, you'll modify it as a sinner because you're never able to keep it, but you know it's a package deal. So you're going to try to make up for your falling down over here by keeping it more strictly over there. Right, the preface of the law gives historical testimony that is necessary then to the right reception of the substance of the law. Look at John 4:39, and this is analogous.
John 4:39, and many of the Samaritans of that city believed on him for the saying of the woman, which testified, "He told me all that ever I did."
Yet many believed because of the saying of the woman. They believed on Christ because of her testimony, that where she tells him everything that she ever did. All right. How do we receive Christ aright? Well, the fact is, we first have to receive him in the right way. The right reception of Christ is to recognize, as this woman does, he is God. Only God could have told her all this stuff about her. So she is testifying that he is in fact Jehovah, Yahweh, Adonai. That he is that sacred name, that sacred name of God. That's what she's testifying to. There's not going to be a right reception of Christ if you don't understand that he in fact is this covenant God. Right, for this reason, then, Israel is commanded to give attention to bearing testimony to their children and others, that they might be instructed to keep the law evangelically. Look at Isaiah 8:16 and Psalm 78:1 through 8.
Isaiah 8:16, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples.
Psalm 78:1 through 8. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that there might be, that there might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, and whose spirit was not steadfast with God.
Okay, so we're told in Isaiah to bind up the testimony among the disciples. In Psalm 78, we're told some other things. God appointed a law in Israel, and a testimony in Jacob. Is that right?
Jacob, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what it says, verse 5. Testimony in Jacob.
Testimony in Jacob. Mm-hmm. And a law in Israel. Now, what does that tell us? What's the difference between Jacob and Israel?
The one's the father.
Jacob
is the son.
Yeah,
but. Hmm? No.
Jacob's the individual.
Decon?
Yeah,
Israel.
Right. Israel is Jacob's name.
Who was first?
Jacob was first,
and then Israel. Mm-hmm. So Jacob gets a testimony, and then as Israel receives a law. Right? Mm-hmm. In other words, God's testimony, he's redeemed. He receives the law as a redeemed man.
Did he wrestle the angel when he was Jacob, right?
Correct.
And then he's Israel.
He receives the law. Yeah, the law is appointed to him as Israel.
Well, and it always is some form of historical testimony that brings you to that point of redemption.
We're gonna talk about that in a minute. Yeah, but the point is, first of all, the preface of the Ten Commandments is God's historical testimony.
Isn't that his eternal testimony to us?
But what happens, the divine testimony has to become our testimony.
Right.
And when it becomes our testimony, it only becomes our testimony in history. Yeah, God's testimony is, at one level, we could say his testimony is from eternity. It's election.
But to us... In relation to us.
It's always historical.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, we have to make our calling and election sure. That happens in time and space. So, the divine testimony becomes our testimony as we become conformed to the image of the Redeemer. 1 Corinthians 1:6.
1 Corinthians 1:6. Even as the testimony of Christ was confirmed in you.
Even as the testimony of Christ was confirmed in you. How can the testimony of Christ be confirmed in you? How can any testimony be confirmed in you? Well, the fact is, testimony is confirmed in you because you own that divine testimony. And that testimony no longer is simply the divine testimony of God in you, but it is your testimony. God's testimony becomes your testimony when he redeems you. God's testimony becomes something transmittable, something that can be bound up among the disciples, something that you can teach to your children when he redeems you. God's testimony becomes historically conditioned in the salvation of his people. But his testimony sets the standard. Just like the Bible sets the standard for all confessions of faith, God's testimony sets the standard for all testimony bearers.
Which I guess the children of Israel understood that because, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord," they would whisper in the ears of their children, bearing testimony. They understood that idea.
And they're bearing testimony that God is their God by way of covenant. So they're making clear to their children that the reason you keep the law is because God has redeemed you. Not in order to be saved, mm-hmm. but in order to demonstrate that God has redeemed you.
So our lineage, it's not like anything you can really imagine. It is only by covenant that we have a relation, properly speaking, with God.
Yes. It's not given as a republication of the covenant of works. It's given to redeemed people as a rule of life begotten of thankfulness. Look at Romans 4, 4 and 5 and John 4, 42.
Romans 4, verses 4 and 5. Not to him that worketh is the reward not reckoned of grace, but of debt. But to him that worketh not, but believeth on him that justifieth the ungodly, his faith is counted for righteousness.
John 4, verse 42. And said unto the woman, "Now we believe, not because of thy saying, for we have heard him ourselves, and know that this is indeed the Christ, the Savior of the world."
Okay. What is it then? What is that, when you accept that testimony, what does that testimony do? That it, in the case of the woman, it's human testimony, but it moves you from itself back to the divine testimony. Right? The purpose of human testimony is to move you from one contemplation to another. You're not going to be able to make that higher contemplation of the divine testimony without the human testimony. Because you need to be told that God is your God by way of covenant. Children of Israel, if their parents didn't teach them that, they would never have known that. They would have never known that there was any difference between them and someone else in Syria.
So, in a sense, we all must first be Jacob, then Israel.
There is a sense in which every one of us starts out as Jacob. Relying, we need that testimony, and then we're in a position to receive the law as we must receive it now.
So it goes from being a natural obligation to some sort of super added obligation or something.
It's a natural obligation
to all men.
To all men. To redeemed men, there is a super added obligation by reason of the covenant of grace.
Right.
Without this historical testimony, men are rendered impotent to keep the law and covenant of God. Look at Psalm 78, verses 9 through 11.
Psalm 78, verses 9 through 11. Children of Ephraim, being armed and carrying bows, turned back in the day of battle. They kept not the covenant of God and refused to walk in his law, and forgot his works and his wonders that he had showed them.
What happens without that testimony? Ephraim turns back in the covenant and they don't walk in the law. You know, the fact is, without that testimony going before, it's a grievous thing. The law is a grievous thing. You're trying to keep it in order to be saved. It is a grievous thing. You can't do it. And any reflective individual is going to understand their utter inability to keep the law. This is where all this talk comes in. You know, God, the idea that God couldn't possibly be that precise. You know, God isn't going to hold us to that standard, that He knows that we're not perfect. You know, the idea that we're going to...
That is the wrong way to think about it.
Well, there are a lot of people who think that God is just going to grade on a curve, like they're school teachers. It's a bad way to think, but it's the only way to get through life if you're a pagan. Because you're living under a broken covenant of works, you're sensible of the guilt that you're under, and there is no way out. You can't keep the law. Even if you could, it's already been broken. But the more you try to keep it, the more you realize, the more you consciously try to keep the law, the more you should be brought to realize your inability, your utter inability to keep it. Whereas if you approach it from the point of view of what we're talking about and understand the purpose of the preface, you will not be trying to keep the law as a way to gain favor with God. You'll be looking at the law in a very different way.
Saving. You won't look at it as a way to, like, meritorious or whatever, like anabaptistic
right.
kind of...
There's not going to be any kind of meritorious anything attached to that. That's what the preface of the Ten Commandments... We'll talk about this more in a couple of weeks when we look at just the preface. We'll get into this in a little bit more detail. All right? We want to move on and look at what is the substance of the commandments themselves. What do we mean by this? Well, by substance, we're talking about the internal framework upon which the whole matter of the moral law is suspended. But the word substance means literally to stand, something which stands under something else in order to its support. The Latin is substantia, sub, under, submarine, under water. Substance is under something which stands. Right? Thus, then, it's used to translate the Hebrew atzmi, which means skeleton, bones, or frame in Psalm 139:15. And it can also be used to refer to something in its embryonic state. It's used to translate galmi in Psalm 139:16.
Psalm 139:16. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were writ, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them.
Okay, so substance is talking about skeletons. You know, the substance of a sermon. Ministers used to have what they called skeleton books. It was just an outline of the sermon. Sermon skeleton. That's what they called them. The substance of the sermon was right there in an outline. The embryonic state, well, again, when we talk about it in terms of time and development, the embryonic state is the early state, which stands behind or under everything else that's going to come. In terms of the law, the substance are these 10 words, Deuteronomy 10:4.
And he wrote on the tables, according to the first writing, the 10 commandments, which the Lord spake unto you in the mount out of the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly, and the Lord gave them unto me.
Yeah, the 10 commandments, the Hebrew there says 10 hadvarim, 10 words. That's what 10 commandments are, 10 words. Yet they support the entirety of the moral law. Look at Mark 12, 29 to 34.
Mark 12, 29 to 34. And Jesus answered him, "The first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment, and the second is like, namely this, Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. There is none other commandment greater than these." And the scribe said unto him, "Well, Master, thou hast said the truth, for there is one God, and there is none other but he, and to love him with all the heart, and with all the understanding, and with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love his neighbor as himself is more than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices." And when Jesus saw that he answered discreetly, he said unto him, "Thou art not far from the kingdom of God," and no man after that durst ask him any questions.
If we think about this, that the Ten Commandments, as we're going to see in what we'll consider this in a little bit, the Ten Commandments form the substance of this divine testimony. The historical testimony is in the preface. The substance of the testimony is in these commandments. The substance is what directs and forms and circumscribes the being of a thing. If your skeleton is only this big, you're only going to be this big. You know, what you are, what you become, is in some sense already there genetically in your embryo. In your embryonic state, everything that you'll ever be is all wrapped up right there. You know, the embryo of a horse is not going to become a person, human being. Just isn't going to happen. So the substance then is what is forming and circumscribing. The law does this for the Bible, right? These 10 words give form to the entire Bible. The Bible is inconceivable apart from this. And first of all, redemption isn't necessary if there is no fact of sin. But the fact of sin, well, you see, that's a matter of historical testimony. The fact of sin comes in. The law argues from the fact of sin to our condemnation and our need of redemption. That's what the covenant of works has done. A human testimony that precedes the covenant of works for everyone. And the covenant of works just has human testimony going before it, reminding you, you broke the law. Right, this is what the law does then for the people of God, both individually and corporately. It circumscribes, it forms, it directs. Look at Proverbs 3, 1 to 6 and Psalm 119, 1.
Proverbs 3, verses 1 through 6. My son, forget not my law, but let thine heart keep my commandments. For length of days and long life and peace shall they add to thee. Let not mercy and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck, write them upon the table of thine heart. So shalt thou find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths.
Psalm 119, verse 1. Blessed are the undefiled in the way who walk in the law of the Lord.
The whole point of the law is to form who you are as an individual or as a church or as a nation. The law gives direction. The law draws a clear line, circumscribes. Everything inside the line is holy, everything outside the line is unholy. That gives form to everything, individual or corporate. Right, this composes then the law, that is, composes a doctrinal testimony of God by which we come to know him by participating in his likeness. Colossians 3.10 and John 14.15.
Colossians 3.10, and have put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him.
John 14.15, if ye love me, keep my commandments.
You love me, keep my commandments. Put on the new man, renewed in knowledge, righteousness, true holiness. What is that? Well, as we keep the law, as we, if you will, experientially participate in the law, we become like God, and so the doctrinal testimony becomes embedded in us. It becomes part of our testimony that we're going to bear, whether as individuals or as churches or as nations. The law becomes part of the genetic code of redeemed people. It's a substance. People don't like the law, don't like all of this talk about covenanting and testimony bearing, and they shouldn't. They shouldn't like it, and the reason they don't like it, fundamentally, the reason people have a problem with the law is they're not redeemed. If you're redeemed, there's nothing to fear from the law. There's everything to gain from the keeping of the law, nothing to lose by keeping the law. Except a lot of bad practices and bad opinions. All right, question four then. What should be understood by the several reasons annexed to the commandments? Well, several reasons remind us of the covenantal context of the law to which we're directed. Hosea 8:1.
Hosea 8:1, set the trumpet to thy mouth, he shall come as an eagle against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law.
They transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. Keeping the law and keeping covenant are often used interchangeably because fidelity to the covenant is displayed in the keeping of the law. Malachi 2:4-9.
And ye shall know that I have sent this commandment unto you, that my covenant might be with Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. My covenant was with him of life and peace, and I gave them to him for the fear wherewith he feared me, and was afraid before my name. The law of the truth was in his mouth, and iniquity was not found in his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity, and did turn many away from iniquity. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But ye are departed out of the way, ye have caused many to stumble at the law, ye have corrupted the covenant of Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore have I also made you contemptible and base before all the people, according as ye have not kept my ways, but have been partial in the law.
The fact is that the law and keeping the law are two different things. The law is a doctrinal declaration. The keeping of the law, on the other hand, benefits from having several reasons annexed to it. The doctrinal testimony of God adds to it what we can call an argumentative testimony. Blessings and curses are next, which add teeth to the matter of covenant keeping. Blessing for obedience, cursing for disobedience. Deuteronomy 28, 1, 2, and 15.
Deuteronomy 28, verses 1, 2, and 15, verses 1 and 2. And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and to do all his commandments which I commanded thee this day, that the Lord thy God will set thee on high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come on thee and overtake thee, if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God. And verse 15. But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee.
So God has commanded blessing for obedience, cursing for disobedience. Again, there's no neutral position here. If you obey, God will bless you. If you disobey, God will curse you. There's no middle ground. In both, then, God displays his faithfulness. And that's what you should view it as. God blesses obedience and curses disobedience because, you see, God is faithful to the covenant. Either one. But when it comes to the keeping of the law, God is faithful to the covenant on his part. But with regard to his people in particular, he's faithful by schooling them in holiness, without which fellowship with the Lord is not possible. Hebrews 12:14.
Hebrews 12:14. Follow peace with all men, and holiness without which no man shall see the Lord.
There has to be holiness in order to have fellowship with God. Why is it then that this covenant is bound back over to us in the covenant of grace? Because holiness is a matter of keeping the law of God. Without holiness, we can't know God. We can't have fellowship with God. We can't participate in the divine. We're shut out from it. God is a most holy being. We are, by reason of sin, most unholy.
And correct me if I'm wrong. If God, all these people that freak out about, you know, oh, God can't, really about saying God isn't that precise, so God couldn't possibly keep track of it. Really what they're saying is they just honestly don't want to keep the law. They don't have the ability to keep the law. But if, in fact, God was not faithful, which is one of the things they're sort of trying to get at, they're hoping for at least, there would be no salvation, because tied up in our salvation is God's faithfulness to this covenant.
Yes.
So they're for the satisfaction of the flesh, they totally erase the ability for man to be saved, or they try to. I mean, they don't do it in reality. In their minds, they have actually, not only have they continued to answer the call of sin, but they've actually, they're living in this continual state of damnation, and they can see no way out of it because they've seared themselves.
Right, and this is what covenant does is, and this we can say this about the covenant of works or the covenant of grace. The covenant displays practical arguments for keeping the commandments of God. And it does so in the face of man's arguments against keeping them. Job 23:3-6. Job 23:3-6.
Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. I would order my cause before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say unto me. Will he plead against me with his great power? No, but he would put strength in me.
Yeah, Job understands something about the nature of the God he serves. He says that God will give him arguments back. God will put arguments in his mouth. What is it that the preface to the Ten Commandments is doing? It's putting an argument in your mouth against the keeping of the law as a covenant of works. God is giving you an argument why you don't have to keep the law as a covenant of works. Why you cannot merit salvation by works. God says, you don't have to. I've already redeemed you. Job's friends don't get that point. They think that Job has to do something in order to save himself. Job, on the other hand, understands that his suffering under the law is making him more holy. Why? Job understands he's broken the law, but he's broken it under a covenant of grace, the umbrella of a covenant of grace, not as a covenant of works. And so what's coming to him is not intended for his destruction. It's intended to conform him to holiness so he can have fellowship with God. It's not to destroy him. It's not to knock the wind out of him forever. In fact, many, many reprobates get treated better in this life than God's people do. Because again, as I pointed out, they have eternity to make up for the breaking of the law. We, on the other hand, if we are saved, must satisfy the demands at a temporal level in time.
And is that...
That's a matter of covenant. Covenant has bound up, in the covenant, there is bound up with the law blessings and cursings.
And
for individuals, for families, for churches, for nations.
That is, on one level, bearing testimony to the law? Or is that, I'm asking, like, is it the fact that we have
Covenant.
When we're subject to the curse by reason of breaking the law, subject to God's anger by reason of breaking the law, is that an evidence?
If you're God's child, God, it is a matter of God's faithfulness that He keeps covenant with you. That is, right. That He allows the curse to have its effect in time. So that you know that you've angered Him, that you've disappointed Him, that you have moved in a direction apart from having fellowship with Him. If you didn't get that kind of feedback, you would not be in the process of being conformed to the image of Christ.
Well, and if you don't bind yourself, or if you're not bound to that possibility of being whacked through the covenant, there's no possibility of the blessings through the covenant.
Right.
Either.
I think.
Yeah, when we talk about covenant here, I want to be clear, we're not talking about the doctrine of covenanting per se.
Right, no.
We're talking about the covenant of works or the covenant of grace, particularly. Now, covenanting is what God's people do in response to the covenant of grace. In other words, you don't simply go through life tripping over God's covenant, but you own that explicitly. As an individual, as families, churches, nations. Okay?
I have a quick question about the law again. So, to sort of harken back to what we were talking about, the preface and the moral law, the idea that, like, these men that want to sort of meritoriously work their way into a state of salvation,
Is that taking... I guess the preface to the Ten Commandments really is a lot more important, because are they just... Are they only paying attention to the law and not the testimony?
Unsaved men don't have access to the testimony.
So the preface to the moral law...
Unsaved men only come to the divine testimony by first hearing the human testimony.
Okay.
That's the nature of what is going on. I mean, what makes the testimony orthodox, what makes anyone's testimony orthodox, is that your testimony conforms to the what is normative in the divine testimony. As right. Your testimony reflects the divine testimony, your testimony is orthodox. Heretical teachings, the problem with heresy is it begins with divine testimony and pairs off with human testimony and points away from the divine testimony. It points in a different direction. Orthodox testimony begins... For believers, we begin with human testimony and move to the divine testimony. Unbelievers begin with the divine testimony and they create their own testimony. Whether it's heresy or just paganism. But they're moving in the other direction. They're moving away from the divine testimony to establish their own testimony. Whereas our testimony is to be turned back, focused on this divine testimony. Why? Because ultimately the divine testimony is what? God has redeemed us. And apart from that piece of understanding, you are going to approach the law in the wrong way again and again and again. If you think that the law and the gospel are fundamentally opposed, you're never going to come to that realization. You it makes no sense to you. The preface to the Ten Commandments makes no sense to you. Why did God bother telling them he brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage? Why did he bother telling them that before he says, therefore, because I did this, therefore?
Is that some sort of picture of what he's done to us? The house of bondage out of the land of Egypt, I brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Is that a, sort of a picture of what he's done to us?
Bringing us out of a broken covenant of works.
Right. Subject.
Yeah, the covenant of works, the world. Covenant of works is the house of bondage.
Right. Absolutely.
And what are the Hebrews doing in Egypt? They're making bricks without straw.
Yeah.
They can never do enough for Pharaoh. The more they try to do, the more Pharaoh asks them to do. And they keep getting more and more stuff.
Punishments too. Like,
right.
They just keep getting like whaled.
They keep getting whaled again and again and again and again, and they still don't get it.
That's actually really interesting. I never thought about that.
Right. The law then provides the facts or the doctrine from which an evaluation or an argument can be made regarding covenant keeping in history. And that's exactly what we see Stephen doing in Acts 7, verses 1, 24 to 26, and 51 to 53.
Verse 1, then said the high priest, are these things so? 24 through 6. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him, and avenged him that was oppressed, and smote the Egyptian. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. And the next day he showed himself unto them as they strove, and would have set them at one again, saying, sirs, ye are brethren, why do ye wrong one to another? 51-3. Ye stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, ye do always resist the Holy Ghost, as your fathers did, so do ye. Which of the prophets have not your fathers persecuted? And they have slain them, which showed before the coming of the Just One, of whom ye have been now the betrayers and murderers, who have received the law by the disposition of angels, have not kept it.
Okay, so what does Stephen do? Well, when he's asked, is this so? He begins by telling them the history, right? He gives them the history of how God has redeemed them again and again and again and again. And then he brings up the law. Now, behind all of this is the fact that some things were right and some things were wrong. Moses saw an Egyptian doing wrong to a Hebrew brother. And then he saw two Hebrew brothers doing wrong to each other. And he sought to set it right. Well, how do you do that? Oh, you need a knowledge of the law. And then he draws from that certain... He starts to argue a point and he draws conclusions. You have resisted the Holy Ghost. You're a stiff-necked people.
Does the Holy Ghost bear testimony in the hearts of the people?
Yes, in the hearts of God's people.
Right. In the hearts of God's people.
Yes.
So that's what they're doing.
Well, they're resisting that.
Right.
They're resisting the divine testimony. But Stephen is pressing them with human testimony. Mm-hmm. Right. He is bearing testimony. Mm. He's calling attention to these very things. He's calling attention to history, doctrine, and he's arguing from it. Right? Those are the three elements of his testimony. History, there's historical testimony, there's doctrinal testimony, and there's argumentative testimony going on. And he draws conclusions. And he keeps hammering them with this. And that brings us into the last thing we want to consider right now. What is displayed to us in these three special things we observe in the commandments? Well, these three things display to us the nature of testimony bearing as exemplified by God to his people in the giving of the law. Look at Deuteronomy 5:31-33. We want to compare to 2 Kings 17:13-15.
Deuteronomy 5:31-33. But as for thee, stand thou here by me, and I will speak unto thee all the commandments and the statutes and the judgments which thou shalt teach them, that they may do them in the land which I give them to possess it. Ye shall observe to do therefore as the Lord your God hath commanded you. Ye shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. Ye shall walk in all the ways which the Lord your God hath commanded you, that ye may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which ye shall possess.
So what does God do right there? What does he do? When God bears testimony to Israel, he says what? He, again, goes back to this historical testimony. I've redeemed you. I brought you out of the house of bondage. Number two, that means you should, if you were thankful, if you were behaving like redeemed people, you should keep my law. Number three, he then goes to annex reasons. Why should you do it? That your days may be prolonged. That you'll live peaceably in the land that I'm going to give you. That's the way God bears testimony to his people. And this has bearing on how the church should bear testimony. 2 Kings 17.
2 Kings 17, verse 13. Yet the Lord testified against Israel and against Judah by all the prophets and by all the seers, saying, turn ye from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I send to you by my servants the prophets. Notwithstanding, they would not hear, but harden their necks like to the neck of their fathers, that did not believe in the Lord their God. And they rejected his statutes and his covenant that he made with their fathers and his testimonies which he testified against them. And they followed vanity and became vain and went after the heathen that were round about them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them.
Again, what happens here? In 2 Kings, the charge is, and we're told, the Lord, it's the covenant name of God there, the Lord testifies to his people. He bears testimony against them. What does he say? He's already, by reminding them, he is the Lord. He's telling them, I'm in covenant with you. And what have you done? You've broken my commandments. And then he begins to list all kinds of reasons and arguments. This is why this happened to you. And this is the result. Why did you end up becoming idolaters? Why did you end up becoming all of these horrible things? Why did you go into bondage? Well, because you broke my law. You rejected the covenant. You rejected it. You can't reject it. You rejected it how? By not keeping the law. That doesn't mean you're out of covenant with God. If you're God's child, he's going to pound you and pound you and pound you until you obey. Because you must be brought into a state of holiness. If you're not getting pounded and you're disobeying the commands of God, you should be worried. You should be very worried. That is a sign of reprobation. That is a worrisome thing. If you can stand up like David said and say about yourself, there are no bands in the death of the wicked. That's not a good thing. That's not a good place for you to be. So faithful testimony bearing then ought always to be composed of history, doctrine, and argument. We're going to look at Acts 10:42-43.
Acts 10:42-43. And he commanded us to preach unto the people and to testify that it is he which was ordained of God to be the judge of the quick and the dead. To him give all the prophets witness that through his name whosoever believeth in him shall receive remission of sins.
Yeah, the preaching of the gospel itself is a faithful testimony. Why? Well, because it joins the history of the covenant God and displays it to us in the face of Jesus Christ, who was sent for our redemption. And from that, God has his people argue in light of the doctrines of Scripture to argue why you should believe. Ultimately, the penalties are grim for those who disbelieve. So it's divine testimony bearing that really is the paradigm for the kind of testimony the church is called to bear in the face of the world. And we see this model, and this is one reason the Ten Commandments, the way the Ten Commandments have come to us, is so important, is because it is a very clear and concise model of testimony bearing in a way that should make clear. If you're a believer, if you're under the covenant of grace, the law is coming to you as a rule of life, and that covenant keeping is the best indication, the best sign of obedience and election that there really is. The idea that having religious feelings or expressing religious sentiments or any other kind of religiosity that is apart from the keeping of the law is false. God gave that summary of the law to Moses not as a republication of the covenant of works. The Jews of Israel, the Hebrew people, were not being called to keep the law in order to be saved. They were given that law as saved people in order to be like their Redeemer. And that's the key. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. Because in doing so, you demonstrate that you are in covenant with God willingly. that you are devoting yourself to him willingly. And the only way you could possibly do that willingly is if you're in covenant with God as a covenant of grace.
Just some other considerations. I was just thinking of some of the things that stuck out to me. God's was, in fact, the point of origin when it came to the law. And our obedience to the law, the more obedient we are to the law, the more it shows our willingness, our willful subjection to the covenant, in which, in turn, that is what makes us like unto God.
Mm-hmm.
Correct? After an hour or so of talking, that's about how long it took me to really even begin to contemplate how serious it was when man fell, and how gracious God has been in keeping that relation with us by covenant, to some of us at least, by covenant. Also, I really like talking about the question one and the special things. That was good on a number of levels. Sort of get an idea as to what special things really are. So, no, not really. I mean, just it's good.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at puritandownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at puritandownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit puritandownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.